blaze, Russian roulette with you, that's right. I said downtown when you're brown on a Friday night blaze, Russian roulette with you. But not with a second-hand Saturday night special, nah. Downtown blaze, Russian roulette with a brand new SJPD revolver. One bullet for injustice, one bullet for intolerance, and one bullet for the self-hating sellout Latino capulero that will never bust enough Mexicans, harass enough Chicanos, or beat the shit out of enough cholos to feel equal to his Caucasian counterparts. You see, downtown when you're brown, Officer Lopez is hunting down Chicanos like the Terminator, hoping in vain that one day he may be able to wake up and scrub the brown out of downtown, or at the very least, out of his own skin. Downtown! Downtown when you're brown, the muffled sound of injustice is drowned out by the boom, boom, boom of tricked out Impalas and cherried out mini trucks. As the catcalls of oppression are heard up and down Santa Clara streets, and beautiful Latinos strut by on Saints Deep in midnight blue Buick Rivieras with gold smokes and silver crucifixes hanging from the rearview mirror. Downtown when you're brown on a Friday night, all the signs say no cruising zone, but what they really mean is no fucking Mexican zone. Because SJPD will pull you over for being downtown and round, and for no other reason. And you will find yourself at the corner of 27th and Santa Clara in a McDonald's parking lot, surrounded by four police cruisers, while two bigs in SWAT gear search your car illegally, and a third one frisks you. And now I'm not talking about no pussy little frisk like you see in front of a club. I'm talking about a real motherfucking frisk like they do on cops when they tell you to spread your legs, put your hands on the hood of the car, and they pat you down so good you think you're getting a hand job. And you know, if they don't find nothing on you, if they don't find nothing on you,
are here in Santa Cruz, California at 96.3 FM for the next 2 hours, as soon as I catch my breath. Hang with me and let's do some civil rights talking and some maybe some walking. That would be even better than talking, wouldn't it? We're going to have special guests tonight. Veronica and Kiko, who spoke at City Council on Tuesday night at the Oral Communications Section, 7 o'clock. Some of you who are regulars may have listened to that show. Others who don't want to waste your time with City Council, and I can quite sympathize with that, may have missed it. There were a number of people who spoke about police misconduct. They weren't organized. They weren't orchestrated. They weren't dragged in by me or anybody else. They just happened to show up. And I guess we're going to pursue that subject even further on Sunday when the show returns. We do two shows a week, for those of you who are new. One is Sunday from 11 to 1:30 in the afternoon. The other is on Thursdays today, and every Thursday, 6 to 8 in the evening here on 96.3. Our call-in number, in case you want to reach us, and we do encourage you to call in, 427-3772, 427-3772, easy number to remember. And we'll keep trying to put it out there in case you don't remember it. If you want to reach us off air, it's 423-HUFF, 423-4833, which is the headquarters for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, HUFF. But it's also where the producer of this show is sitting fielding calls in case you want to talk about stuff off air that you're a little bit uncomfortable talking about on the air. You want to first kind of set the scene, or possibly you have some messages you want to pass on without being public at this particular point about them. So, before we get into our guests who are here, We may even get another guest coming up. There's another speaker from the city council meeting of last Tuesday who was concerned about police misconduct who may show up. But we at least have two folks who I think I'm really glad to see here, Kiko and Veronica. Before I introduce them, though, I'm going to play a little bit of an interview that happened the interview happened just an hour ago, but the incident that provoked it was the demolition of the statue of Christopher Columbus over in San Jose. I think that was on Thursday. A man who's admitted demolishing it, Jim Costner, local activist, went to court this morning, and he's now being defended by attorney Larry Hildes. And we had an interview with Larry. We're going to play that interview now, and then we're going to launch into live on-air discussion of police conduct in Santa Cruz. We're going to have two folks discussing their concerns about that. But first, a little bit about Jim Costner, who's currently in jail on $50,000 bail over in San Jose. Hi, it is March 15th, about 5:10 in the afternoon, on the line with attorney Larry Hildes, also activist Larry Hildes. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Robert.
And you came all the way down from Berkeley to San Jose today to help a man named Jim Costner. Who's Jim and what's happening?
Well, Jim was arrested. Jim is a longtime activist in Santa Cruz on a variety of issues, Indian rights issues, homeless issues, and so on. Was arrested last Thursday. He decided to do some redecorating to a statue of Columbus.
Uh-huh.
He was offended that there was a statue of Columbus at San Jose City Hall, such a public building, and took a sledgehammer to it and did quite significant damage. Frankly, a couple more blows and it looks like he would have knocked the head off, along with the legs and one arm and part of a hand.
But the spirit of Columbus lives on.
Yes.
Wasn't Columbus this famous conquistador who wiped out, 1 to 3 million, he and his son, and I guess the man after him, in the course of 60 or 70 years, the entire population of Hispaniola was eliminated?
That is correct. Great hero.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's good if you need a depopulation expert, call in Christopher. I mean, they didn't have the atomic bomb in those days.
It's amazingly efficient for the Spanish who sent him were quite good at genocide by that point.
Wow. Oh. And so he also, I understand, exported Native American slaves back to Europe. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And this is exactly the kind of thing we want to talk about. Apparently, they have his bail at $50,000, which is basically murder and serial rapist bail. And the DA was arguing today that it should be higher. She said that they were getting a great deal of pressure from concerned citizens who were offended by what he had done and claiming that he had done $150,000 worth of damage to the statue. Frankly, I don't think the statue was worth $150,000.
Uh-huh. Well, I understand. I read somewhere, I guess it was the Mercury News, that they're going to try to redo the statue or patch it up and move it somewhere else.
That is apparently the plan.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I went in this morning in front of Judge Stafford to try and get the bail reduced down to a reasonable level so we could get Jim out. And I announced my purpose, and the judge responded by saying, I set the bail. It's what I think it should be.
And did he give any explanation for this? I mean,
no.
Did you have cases in point to indicate that? I guess he's charged with felony vandalism and felony second-degree burglary. Are those the two charges?
That is correct. And the felony vandalism, ironically, is with a hate crime enhancement. I want to know who this group is, who this oppressed group is, who he's supposed to be directing hate to.
Well, maybe war criminals and the genocidal murderers are, in a sense, an endangered group, and he is attacking a particular group of much maligned individuals. Although Columbus is, I guess, occasionally maligned, but usually he's revered, right?
Which is one of those bizarre things that the victors get to make the history.
Now, was this some sort of sinister... Are they alleging this was a sinister conspiracy where...
No.
He was slipped a sledgehammer and, he was...
Basically, they are saying that he's crazy and therefore dangerous.
Or they claim that he's a psychiatric case or that he's crazy but cold-blooded and...
Right, all of that. Apparently, he gave an interview to the police, which they videotaped, which we have not seen yet, and which, frankly, I had kept his mouth shut, and talked a lot about God and genocide, and they decided, because he believed so strongly in this, that he must be crazy.
Hmm.
After all, Columbus was a hero, wasn't he? Anybody who would sledgehammer a statue of Columbus must be crazy.
Oh, well, he is one of our conquistador heroes, if you want to consider... I guess if you want to consider the Nazi pantheon, the Führer himself would be considered quite a hero.
Yes.
Within his own circle, of course.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And we're going to try and narrow the circle. We're not going to argue that Jim didn't do it. He did it. He's proud of having done it. We can't really argue necessity because Columbus is dead. Basically, what we're going to do is put Columbus on trial. And we're going to try and explain to a jury how offensive this is.
You think the judge, is your trial judge going to be the judge that sets the bail?
No, he's gone. I told him I was going to remove him from the case, and he said, I'm not going to hear it anymore anyway.
Uh-huh.
So he's gone.
So is there a chance of getting a new bail hearing before a new judge?
Monday. Monday at 1:30, we have a bail hearing. We're going to have a press conference at 1 o'clock. I dictated about half the press release to the support person. We need a packed courtroom. Anybody who can get over the hill, we need people there.
This is Monday at what time?
1:30. Monday the 19th at 1:30. We don't know what the department will be. We will be meeting out front at 1 o'clock. We'll go into Department 23, which is in the basement of the new building, and they will send us somewhere else.
And this is in San Jose. I guess I would encourage people, if you want instructions on how to get to this San Jose Courthouse, give a call to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUF, 423-4833. Larry, what penalties does Jim Costner face?
Well, he cannot be sentenced for both the burglary and the vandalism, because the vandalism is an element of the burglary. He can only be sentenced for one or the other, but potentially 3 years in prison.
And
they could try to make him pay the cost of the stupid statue.
Uh-huh. Is there much public sentiment you've talked to? I mean, do people sort of snarl and spit at you as you walk down the street, Larry, once they've learned you're taking this case? Do they shake your hand, congratulate you? I've had several people who I didn't know, really, who didn't know Jim Costner, look at this press release and say, right on, Jim. What's the reaction you've been hearing?
Well, I haven't gotten much yet. This is the first time I've appeared in the case. I will be in the Mercury News tomorrow, as presumably will Jim. They had a reporter there. I did go over to the scene of the crime.
So you say you went to the scene of the crime to catch the debris of the Columbus statue, and what did you see?
Well, there were a couple of bunches of flowers there, but I also stood there for a while and tried to hear what people were saying. Didn't hear much. A lot of people just didn't understand it or thought it was really funny. There were a couple of people who were just mortally offended.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think most people understood it, and that's going to be our job over the course of the time between now and the trial, and then during the trial, is to make people understand exactly why he did it, why it was appropriate.
How can people help, Jim? You suggested they show up at 1:30 on Monday. I guess it's the, looks like the 18th?
19th,
thank you.
Yes, that would be a very big help. Money is always helpful, especially if we're trying to get him out. If they don't reduce his bail, we have to get him out of there. It makes the whole case more difficult, and it makes his situation much more dangerous if he's in there. He's identified white supremacists in the area with him, and it would just be better all around to get him.
You mean by that white supremacists who might do him some danger?
That would be my concern, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He's in very good spirits, but he would be in a lot better spirits if we had him out. There's always, money for logistical stuff related to the suit. We're going to need witnesses. We're going to need experts who can talk about Columbus and about genocide of Native Americans. A lot of stuff like that we're going to need. The biggest thing we need initially is people to show up, though. We want to fill the courtroom.
Uh-huh.
We want it to be clear to whatever judge hears this case on Monday that he has support. Because they have made it clear, both the judge and the DA made it very clear, that they are getting a lot of pressure from the Italian-American groups that put the statue up, demanding that he basically be hung.
Mm.
And they keep demanding his bail be higher. The DA's office was threatening to demand $100,000 bail.
I see. Hang him high, hang him higher, eh?
Yes.
So, I guess, where can people send money?
I guess they can send it to, much as I always hate to do this, they can send it to my office. I don't know what the support, what the local contact information for him is at this point.
Well, why don't we give your office and hope that you will not be filching his checks?
I am honor-bound not to do that. My office address is 1840 Woolsey Street, W-O-O-L-S-E-Y, in Berkeley, 94703. Either make the checks out to him or make them out to me and notate in the note box for Jim Costner.
C-O-S-N-E-R?
C-O-S-N-E-R, and they will go to his case. They will not go to anything else.
And if any local support persons for the Costner Defense Fund are listening...
They are saying that he's crazy and therefore dangerous.
Or they claim he's a psychiatric case or that he's crazy but cold-blooded and...
Right, all of that. Apparently, he gave an interview to the police which they videotaped, which we have not seen yet, and which, frankly, I had kept his mouth shut. In the note box for Jim Costner...
C-O-S-N-E-R.
C-O-S-N-E-R, and they will go to his case. They will not go to anything else.
And if any local support persons for the Costner Defense Fund are listening in, and you have a more local number and address,
that would be great.
Please call in and let us know. It's call-in number here at Free Radio is 427-3772. We're talking and have been talking to Larry Hildes, Berkeley attorney for Jim Costner, who... brought down the celebrated Christopher Columbus with a number of blows to the thigh and buttocks, apparently, the statue at the...
Knocked off both legs.
Knocked
one
off
arm,
both legs.
One hand.
And I think that covers the gist of it. We got a little garbled on the tape there towards the end. My apologies, folks. It's we have a crowded studio and new equipment and a... completely incompetent broadcaster, but aside from that, we're doing just great. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. If you want more information about the Costner case, and again, that attorney Larry Hildes is urging people to pack the courtroom on 1:30 Monday in the San Jose courthouse, you want to give a call to 423-HUFF, and we will give you the more specific address, directions to get there, or hopefully direct you in the direction to go so you can get those directions. If you have any thoughts on this subject, Columbus statue smashing, a fit subject for support by Santa Cruz activists, feel free to give a call. I'm of the mind myself, it's not anything I would recommend for me, you, or anybody else, frankly, but I would understand when it was done, why it was done, given the fact that Columbus is indeed, as the press release that I'm looking at here says, a celebrated mass murderer. And I'm going to read the first four paragraphs of this press release because I think it gives out some interesting and accurate information. Wielding a sledgehammer, justice activist James Costner smashed a life-size statue of Christopher Columbus in front of dozens of witnesses at City Hall in San Jose, California, on Thursday, March 8th. As the seven types of marble chips flew from the blows, Costner shouted, "Genocide! This man rode our backs! This man murdered us." And it's actually true that the Spaniards actually saddled and rode Arawak Indians. I mean, it's not some sort of metaphor. It's actually a literal statement according to accounts of the time. "Most Americans do not know the murderous history of Christopher Columbus. Examining primary historical sources by Bartolomeu de las Casas, the biographer of Columbus's son, Columbus made four voyages to the New World. He encountered the Arawaks, who occupied Haiti, or Hispaniola, if you look at the whole island. An early estimate of the Arawak was 1.1 million, not counting children. According to conservative estimate, over 3 million Arawaks lived on Haiti in pre-Columbian times, if you count the estimates rather than simply the smaller census. Columbus kidnapped, enslaved, and murdered the Arawak people. He ruled with severe discipline, ordering the cutting off of ears or nose as punishment for minor crimes. When the Arawaks fought back, Columbus used the excuse to wage war. On March 24, 1495, Columbus set out to conquer the Arawaks with 20 hunting dogs, horses, and guns. Columbus set upon the Arawaks, tearing them up with dogs and mowing them down with volleys of bullets and running them over with horses. Reporting back to Queen Isabella of Spain, Columbus boasted in the name of the Holy Trinity, we can send from here all the slaves that Brazil will hold. And in fact, the slave trade didn't begin going from Africa to America. It started going from Hispaniola back to Europe and to other parts of America via Columbus and his fellow conquistadors on Hispaniola. The Spaniards hunted Indians for sport and murdered them for dog food. Seeking gold, he enslaved the remaining Arawaks to work the mines. Those who refused had their hands cut off. What they would do is they would put a kind of a medallion around people's necks. And if you didn't have your medallion, then you were vulnerable to having your hands cut off. That was the way they dealt with it, according to the historians I've read. Conditions for the Arawak became so intolerable that as many as 100 at a time would commit suicide. Women were known to kill their newborn babies rather than have them raised in such hideous circumstances. Columbus would reward his officers with women to rape. Girls 10 to 12 were especially desired for rape. When Columbus' son took over in 1505, he continued the slaughter. Only some 12,000 remained by 1516. By 1555, not a single Arawak remained. Haiti remains one of the primary instances of genocide in human history, to be followed by more instances of genocide in Puerto Rico and Cuba. The presence of the statue prominently placed in City Hall in San Jose has been reviled by Native Americans as a sick reminder of the ruthless slaughter and conquest of indigenous people in the New World. And there's more to this press release. Sources for historical information on Columbus's genocidal policies: History of the Indies by Bartolomé de las Casas, Select Letters of Christopher Columbus, translated and edited by R.H. Major, People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn, Log of Christopher Columbus's First Voyage to America in the year 1492, as copied out in brief by Las Casas. And all these come from the book Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, by James W. Lowen. I think I actually read most of this in the last broadcast. But, hey, it's worth considering. Indeed, it's vandalism to destroy a statue, but perhaps it's a form of creative and positive vandalism when you destroy a statue of a mass murderer, because what kind of an example is that setting for our society, our children, those in our future? But you can comment on this, or you can comment on whatever else you'd like to comment on around civil rights issues here at Free Radio. I see the lines are beginning to light up, or the line is lighting up since we have only one line in. 427-3772 is our number.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert Merlin.
Hey, Merlin.
That person thinks Jim is a hero.
Say, you think Jim's a hero?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you read all about this, what Christopher Columbus did. You know, no offense to the Italian people that built this statue and paid for the money to have it built and all that stuff.
I think Christopher Columbus is an offense to the Italian people himself.
I think he's a disgrace to the Italian people and the American people, not to mention a degradation to the Indian people.
Yeah, well, it's more like, you know, there were these times for adventurous types who would, you know, get involved in activities of this sort, but I don't think you want to, you know, celebrate them. I mean, it's... I know that it's traditional because that's what American history books have done, but, hey...
I think you ought to lose Columbus Day as a holiday.
I tend to agree with you. I usually call it Indigenous People's Slaughter Day. That's what I usually call it.
You know, I'm happy to see this thing done. Sorry to see Jim did it, because I'm a good friend of his. Sorry to see him do it, man.
Yeah, because...
I'm sorry to see him in jail. I wish Jim wouldn't have done it. I wish somebody else would have done it.
Right.
You know, but I hope all the Indian people back him up over there over the hill in Santa Cruz.
I hear you. Well, thank you. I'm going to roll on to our guests now and see what they think about all this. Anything else you want to say?
That's about it.
All right.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
And, hey, that, well, I mean, it's, you can't get an argument from me, caller, on that one. I'd like to present, however, kind of move on to the next segment of the show, but we aren't precluding any discussion of this Columbus stuff. We have in the studio with us a couple that have experienced some rather interesting contacts with the police department and talked about it on Tuesday night in the evening session of City Council. We have Kiko and Veronica. And I guess, Kiko, you're going to sort of launch off this discussion. How are you doing tonight?
All right.
And what what happened? Give us a pretend that no one here was at City Council. No one heard what you said to the City Council. And give it to us again.
Well, me and two friends who are in from Philly with a rap group called War Club, they were out here doing some shows at the Week of Dragons, the Week for Political Prisoners up in Oakland, and they were down here performing a show up at UCSC. So we were taking a friend home back to his grandma's house so we could be there for work in the morning. but we didn't have no way of transportation, so we asked Veronica if we could use her car, and she was dead sick, so she couldn't even drive. She'd been throwing up all day, so she let us use her car and go up there. He lives on Bay Street, and we're on Blackburn, so it was just a trip up the hill. And on our way back down, after dropping our friend off, the police started following us, and we noticed that they were following us, so we were going up to a friend's house to get Veronica some medicine, and it was up by the old people's home up by, what's that street called? Pacific. And so we stopped, we parked, and then all of a sudden we were getting out of the car, and the police rolled up on us because we had lost sight of them for a little bit after they had been following us.
Now, was this one squad car, Kiko? And how many police were involved in this?
It was two.
And what happened?
So then we were rolling out the car, and then all of a sudden they shined their light on us and told us to get back in. And so when they came over, we asked them what was going on. They wouldn't say nothing. They just kept asking. They asked the driver for his license and the registration for the vehicle and all that. So after that, we were just waiting there asking them what was going on, And they wouldn't tell us. Finally, they said that one of our taillights was out. So we were like, what? Because we knew no taillight was out. So then after we got out the car, because they said they were going to repo the car and that we had to just grab whatever we had in our immediate possession. And
let me interrupt you for a moment. How do you know your taillights weren't out? Did you get out and check them? Or?
Yeah, because when we got out, we got all our stuff, and we were getting ready to leave. We said, let's check the taillight. And then they went in there and turned the key on, and the taillight wasn't out. It was one brake bulb of the brake light that was out, but even with one brake bulb, the brake light still lights up.
And what did they say when, you know, you brought that to their attention?
They didn't say nothing. They said the one bulb's out, and you don't have a license. It doesn't matter. The car's getting taken.
So the driver didn't have a license?
Yeah. And
did someone else in the vehicle have a license?
No, none of us had a license. We were just going to drop a friend off a couple blocks away. And so when we got out, we seen that, and my friend, he got his ticket given to him, and it said the reason we got pulled over was for driving in 20 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. And we never got pulled over, though. So if we were driving 20 miles an hour, they would have pulled us over while we were doing it.
Let me ask you this. What skin color were these officers?
White.
And what color are you?
Red.
And what color are you, Veronica?
Yellow-brown.
this is all very colorful, but let me ask you, what's your ancestry? You're Cambodian, Veronica, and you, Kiko, are...
An Arawak Indian.
And you actually are, should we say... you're an Arawak Indian? No way. You mean you were one of the survivors who got it? What, did you swim away? What happened? So they were lying to us in this textbook. Somebody got away. I better call Columbus's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson here.
Yeah.
Perhaps I better not.
I was going to mention that after we got done with this, that don't believe the hype. We're still here and alive after 500 years.
Well, I mean, actually, I'm glad to hear that. When did all this happen? What was the date of this?
This was February 14th on Valentine's Day.
And what time of day or night did this go on?
It was like 2:30 in the morning.
What time was it?
One in the morning.
About 1 in the morning. And were there any witnesses? Did anybody come out of their houses? Or was this in a residential area?
This was like on the way, on halfway down to the hill up by a car dealership. And by, on the top of the hill, there's the old people's home. So there was cars parked the whole way, and there's meters right there. So we parked right in front of one of the meters. And that's where it all happened. Nobody was there to see
now,
nothing.
Now, were you pulled over, or did you just park?
No, we had parked, and then they came up on us after the keys were out of the ignition, and the two people in the front were out of the car, or had their bodies out of the car, and
so
I was on my way out.
The police had not put on their sirens or their blinking red light?
No, they just shined a light on us.
And yet they claimed that they had the right to move your vehicle and to tow it because there was no registered or licensed driver there?
Yeah, because there was no licensed driver. But the thing is, they could have never known that if they didn't shine the light on us because we were already parked.
And did they end up towing the vehicle?
Yeah, they towed the vehicle.
And where is the vehicle now?
Well, we got the vehicle back after we went to the police chief. And
Police Chief Steve Belcher?
We went to the police chief afterwards, but we got the car back. We talked to Sergeant McMahon in Internal Affairs, and I had my parents. But we should probably finish the story because this wouldn't make sense.
Okay, go ahead. Finish the story first.
So then we got we went and got Veronica because we didn't know what was. I mean, we knew what was going on, but this was like out of the blue. We were just like two blocks away from her house. We were just dropping a friend off, and we're going to get something at a friend's house, and then that was it. Yeah, it was like no big deal because she was sick all day. So all we had to do was, it was like pigs pulled us over. We already were just chilling, parked. And so once the car got taken away, we went and got Veronica to see if, because she was the owner of the vehicle, she'd get it back because we knew the towing company would get there quick because it's 1 a.m. So when we got back, the towing company just barely got there, and that's when she started to talk to the officer. I guess she could tell you about that.
Yeah, pick it up from there, Veronica. You were ill, right? You weren't in the best shape out there, right? And this was 2:30 in the morning?
Yeah. Yeah, so I got out there, and I tried to explain the whole situation to them. I offered them my ID, my registration, my insurance, and everything, and I tried to explain to them that the car is actually registered under my mother's name, and we have different last names because she's remarried. And I tried to explain the whole thing to them, and they didn't even want to look at my ID. And in any case, although our last names are different, everything else would have matched up, our addresses, our policy numbers, and everything. It would have been really obvious that I was a legal driver of the car, and I have a license. And there is a law that says that someone caught without a license will have the vehicle towed, but if the registered owner is not present. But I am the registered owner, and I do have a license, and I'm a legal driver of the car, so there was no reason for the car to be towed. And so we tried to reason with her. I tried to reason with her numerous times calmly, and she was unwilling to listen. So I asked her if I could get my books out of the trunk because I had school the next day. I go to school at the university. And she said no, that I couldn't touch my car. And I said that was fine, that she could get it out for me. And she refused to. And I said, okay, well, can you at least turn my headlights off? Because the car was being towed, it was already on the thing, it didn't need to be driven anywhere, there was no reason for the lights to be on. And I told her if you didn't turn the lights off, the batteries would die. And she said she refused to. And I said, well, can you please roll my windows up, because my windows were completely rolled down. And it had been raining, if you will remember, that whole week, so if it had rained, my car would have been drenched. And I asked her very calmly and politely, and it wasn't like she told me I couldn't touch the car. I said, that's fine, can you please do it for me? And she refused to, so
I interrupt you for a moment. Who was the officer you were, who was this woman?
The officer's name were Benny and Klein, badge 181 and 189, and I don't know which one she is, but she was either Benny or Klein.
They were both female officers?
No, it was a woman and a man.
Mm-hmm. So one was Officer Benny and one was Officer Klein?
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. So you said that you attempted to get her to roll up the windows because it was likely to rain or had rained, and what happened then?
And she said no. So I reached for the car door to do it myself, and she got up on me, and I said, don't touch me. And she got up on me again, and I pushed her up, and I said, don't touch me. And the two men who were with me said, get your hands off her, and she reached for her gun, and she called like 4 or 5 backup cars. Do you remember how many?
Total, like what? Once they got there, there was like 6-7 cars there, just for nothing, for 3 people.
And what about her fellow officer? Was one of the officers more hot dog than the other, so to speak?
The woman was. The other officer, he's playing like a little bitch in the back.
Meaning
he was just like, he was scared. He was scared of us, and he had the gun. Like we were going to do something, but we were sitting there calm the whole time. He was just scared of the whole situation.
And again, how many of you were there?
At that time there was 3 because we went and got her, and then one of the guys stayed. So it was just like 2-3 of us that went back.
So there were 3 men and 1 woman?
No, 2 men and 1 woman.
2 men and 1 woman, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, so then, let me follow this exactly. So you trying to close your window, Veronica, were told not to do so by the officer. Actually, did she physically, this was the woman who physically sort of interposed herself, or?
Yeah, she physically got in my way and kind of grabbed me, like, by my upper torso.
Uh-huh.
Like my arm.
Was she bigger
shoulders.
Than you or shorter, taller than you?
She's maybe a little bit taller than me.
She's way bigger.
Oh, she was, whatever.
Uh-huh.
Well,
so
she didn't seem that big to me.
And what did she say to you as you were doing this? Or did you remember what she said? Did she say anything?
She didn't say anything. I don't remember her saying anything. She just pushed. She just got up on me.
And so then the two men rose to your defense?
No. They were actually, like, really far from me, maybe 7 to 8 feet at least, and all they said was, get your hands off her. I mean, I was handling myself fine.
Defense.
I just pushed her off me twice, and all they said was, get your hands off her.
So she then pulled her gun?
No.
She reached for it.
She reached for it.
I backed up as soon as I saw that. So she didn't actually pull it.
She made a motion toward her gun. She didn't actually... Did she touch her gun?
Yeah. She was ready to pull it, and I stepped back.
And then what happened?
And then, so at that point, I mean, we were all unarmed, and they had been frisked already, too, when they they were first stopped by the cars. I mean, by the cops. So
by the two officers initially.
So it was already known that nobody was armed or anything, and you know, I mean, we were completely outnumbered with seven police cars.
Now, how long did it take seven police cars? You say you counted seven cars?
I think it was like between five and seven.
Between five and seven, I don't remember exactly.
Uh-huh. So there were at least five police cars. Is that accurate?
Right, because they called backup, so they weren't all there at the same time.
So the woman, let me get the sequence. The female officer called, said she, what did she say exactly? Get me backup or something like that?
She just like put some kind of code into her little mic thing, and then all of a sudden like the things were just winding down. The car was getting towed away. Then all of a sudden like five cars show up. And
how quickly
just
did it
up.
Take those cars to arrive?
Oh, we were like more than a block away from the station, so it wasn't like one minute.
The Santa Cruz Police Station.
Yeah.
Station.
Yeah.
Okay, so the cars arrived. Did they block the street?
Well, they just came in like on all angles. It was like it's just like a one way street.
Okay, and how many police officers would you estimate were there?
Well, there was like one in a car, like
so about
four
to seven police officers.
Yeah, four or five more cars showed up.
Four or five more cars.
Yeah.
So four to five more police officers showed up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what did these police officers do?
They just came out and just would like. Just all of them got out of the cars, like walking around, like I don't know, just kind of lollygagging, like assessing the situation type.
Did anyone pull a gun?
No.
Well, we pretty much left once they got there too. We didn't stay long.
Yeah, because the car was being towed. The car was like the tow truck was gone, and so it was like we were there with like six cop cars. We weren't even trying to stay around.
So soon after these cops, the last police officers pulled up, you took off.
Yeah, we just seen them all come in, and we were like, what the fuck is this? We were like, we're gone.
Now, did they try to stop you, or did they try to speak to you?
No. No, they were, I don't know.
They didn't care who I was. They didn't even want to know whose car it was. I mean, they wouldn't have known who to give the car back to. You know, they were completely uninterested in who we are. They just took our car.
Did you ask for the names and badge numbers of the police officers who stopped you?
Yeah.
And did they give them to you?
Yeah, that's how we got them.
And did you get any explanation as to why they were taking your vehicle, even though you were the registered, or your mother was the registered owner, is that right? Why did they say because you weren't the registered owner, that was why they were taking the vehicle? Or?
No, they said that the information was completely irrelevant. They wouldn't even...
Old police force is racial prejudice, but I mean, so that's the whole reason they pulled us over. So from the get, I mean, it was done on racial prejudice.
And even the ticket that they gave to the driver, he gave them his ID so that they could write the ticket. And if you look on his ID, it says, on the ticket under race, it says black. And then on his ID, it says Indian, Native American Indian. And so it's obvious all they saw was a black man in a car that was turned off. Mm-hmm. And so they towed his car.
Then this case had further consequences. What happened in the days ahead, in the days that followed, I should say?
Well, the next morning we called internal affairs or something like that, and we ended up speaking to Sergeant McMahon. We called different departments of the police, and I had my parents fax in a letter to the police station explaining that I was a legal driver of the car and that I am their daughter, and to release the car to me. And so... after talking to hundreds and hundreds of people, we were able to get a trial in 3 days, and we had to pay $85 for the trial, and then $130 just for them to even decide whether to release the car or not.
Hundreds and hundreds of people, or maybe five or ten people?
Maybe five.
Maybe five people. Felt like hundreds and hundreds of people.
I was being, yeah.
Right, I mean.
I was exaggerating.
And so you had to pay $85 to get your car back. Were you found guilty of anything at this trial? Were you yourself accused?
No, they wouldn't let me talk about anything that happened. The officer who did my hearing, all he wanted to talk about was whether I was really the owner of the car, if I was a legal registered driver of the car. Mm-hmm. That was
registered driver or registered owner, or both?
Or legal registered, yeah, both. Basically, if I was a legal driver of the car, if it could be released to me, because I'm not actually the registered owner, my parents are.
So he determined that you were and it could be released to you?
Yeah.
But what about the fine? What about the cost?
He didn't even want to talk about it. At all. I couldn't talk about anything. I did, but he wasn't listening.
Have you filed a claim with the city for the money that you lost in this incident?
Yes.
And have you talked to an attorney yet?
No, but I did get a number of one today.
You brought this case to city council. You got your car back. What after you didn't have it for 3 days? What did you do during that 3 day period? Walk, hitchhike, take the bus, rent a car. What happened?
Yeah, I bused. I mean, I was real ill too, so it was
quite a hardship.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really, 3 days without a car isn't that bad, but I'm just saying that that's not the point, really. The point is that it was a case of racial profiling. We were, you know, unjustly harassed by the police and had to pay $440 to be fucked with, basically.
Did you file a complaint with our Pufferoonie Police Pal Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board, or they call themselves the CPRB, the Citizens Police Review Board?
No, because we heard basically they have no power.
Although it's often good to do that, even though they don't have power, simply to make a record of what's happening, and I can show you how to do that afterward if you'd like, if you're up for that. This happened on the 14th, and you came to city council, I guess it was 2 days ago, on March, what, 12th? So you it took a while for you to decide to go to city council. Why did you decide to go and speak at city council?
Well, we had been trying to get our money back. I'd spoke with Sergeant McMahon, the police chief, the mayor, the vice mayor, and another city council member.
Christopher Crone, Ed
Porter. I actually called all of them, and I spoke with a few of them. Chris Crone returned a phone call, but I never spoke with him. I spoke with Pat.
And what did the mayor, Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice, say to you?
He was kind of like, oh, racial profiling, that's bad. But we went in there, both of us went in there requesting that if he would meet with us and the police chief to discuss the whole thing. And
did he agree to do that?
No.
What did he say to you when you requested that?
He said, oh, well, I'll try and call him and I'll have to look at the police report. And all he really ended up doing was having the police chief call me.
And that was Police Chief Steve Belcher?
Yep.
And how long after this whole incident did Belcher call you?
Just a few days. It might have been even the next day after he spoke with Tim, though. That wasn't after the incident.
Okay, and how quickly did Tim move on this to get the... Did he initiate the police chief's calling you, or did your...
Yeah, he did. That he's the one who gave him my number.
And what... you didn't call the police chief directly yourself?
I had been trying to get a hold of him, but I wasn't able to, so...
But did you leave a message with the police department that you were looking for him?
Yeah.
So he might have called... But do you think he called because... Did he say, the mayor asked me to call you?
Yeah.
And what was the, how long did your conversation go with the police chief?
It was just a few minutes. He basically, he tried to act like he was concerned and wanted to know my side and really actually ended up cutting me off numerous times and telling me to calm down when I was never excited in the first place. And all he said was, you know, I'll look into it. And I'm not sure if he ever did any kind of formal investigation.
What was the date of the call you had to him, more or less? A week ago, 2 weeks ago?
Maybe 2 to 3 weeks ago.
And have you heard back from him since?
Yeah, probably a week ago I spoke with him.
This is, he called you a second time?
Yeah, he's called me a couple times.
And what was the nature of the second call?
Basically that he feels that the towing was just and that everything that happened should have happened.
And what was your response when you heard this?
Well, I asked him what kind of investigation he did because none of us were included in the investigation.
No one had come and asked you questions or,
nope.
or any of the people in the vehicle?
Nope.
Had they talked to your mom?
Nope.
What did he say when you asked him that question?
Well, he said, I don't remember exactly what he said, but something to the degree that, you know, we did an investigation and we found that the towing,
case closed.
He spoke with officers and basically he feels that their reason for towing the car was right.
And did you have any further communication with him after this conversation?
No.
So in essence, is it fair to say, I'm wondering, did you wait until you'd gotten this, had this conversation with the police chief before you took the issue back in front of city council? Was that
No, because we weren't, I mean, during this whole time, we've been trying to figure out the whole process that you would have to go through to get your money back. Because really, again, there are two issues. One is that we need our money back, and two, that the first part where, you know, obviously the men were stopped because they're men of color.
Did you get your money back? I assume not.
No. That's why, I mean, we didn't feel, you know, we wanted to take other routes before having to, like, go on television humiliating the whole city council, which we never really had a chance to do, but...
Well, then you did go on television,
right.
vicious scoundrels that you are and troublemakers, and you talked to the city council. What kind of a reaction did you get from the council?
I don't know. Well, most of them, I think, already knew about it. Yeah, I think all of them already know about it because we talked to, what's the dude's name? Big dude? No.
Oh, Scott Kennedy.
Scott Kennedy.
And what did Kennedy say to you?
He was kind of more or less just like, yeah, we'll probably be able to get you that back because it shouldn't be that big of a deal to them that they want to keep the money.
A brief pause while we put on a new tape, keeping a record of this show. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I'm your host, Bathrop's Peer Robert Norse. This is Bathrop's Peer's Broadsides, 2 hours of civil rights and civil wrongs. Call-in number, in case you want to join this discussion, is 427-3772. We're talking to Veronica and Kiko, who, as you can hear, if you've been listening, Kiko and companions were stopped by police, and what they claim is a racial profiling incident. Veronica, again, was treated, she felt, as I can understand it, in a racially discriminatory way. The police department and the city council apparently, at least thus far, have not returned the money for a car that was towed with the lights on, the windows open, threats of violence by police, massive police intervention toward the end, all done to a parked car, if the account here is accurate, and I can't say whether it is or not because I wasn't there. But the question is here, what's your reaction, not just to what you've heard, but has anything like this happened to you out there? And have you tried to get some kind of recourse or restitution from the city council, from the police department, from the towing company, from the courts? And how has Santa Cruz and the Santa Cruz police treated you? 427-3772 is the call-in number. Feel free to call in if you'd like. Looking for as specific a story as you can, and I know for a lot of people this is not the easiest thing in the world to do because, you know, when you're dealing with armed men who have the force of law behind them and politicians who are essentially willing to rubber stamp anything the police chief does, at least that's been my experience, it's not an easy task to go public with difficult situations when you are abused or you feel you've been abused. How did you talk to the city council? Have you gotten any feedback from your discussion with the city council? Did people come up to you and say, I'm glad you said that, or why are you just criticizing our police department, or boy, you were stupid, now you're a target, or yeah, I'm glad you, whatever. What was the result of all that?
Nothing really. I mean, not really much.
Except some hack radio guy came up and asked you to be on the radio.
Huh? Yeah, I mean, we've kind of been just spreading around like what happened, and because this is, in terms of police incidents, this is like one of the minor ones that I've experienced. I've experienced some weird shit with pigs just in general. But, I mean, this just hit us real hard just because the whole financial situation, and it was like guys from out of town, they came in, and it was just like, you know what I mean, something that happens every day, though. I mean, know that. This isn't something unique or some major incident. This was just...
What you said, now, yeah, every day. Now, did something happen like that today? When's the last similar incident you heard? I mean, give me an example of something else that's happened more recently, if you can.
Well, I mean, it wasn't, but just like... I mean, every day I know something else that happens, and I can say, like, I couldn't say, like, on a today basis, but I know every day somewhere somebody gets fucked with by some pigs. But here in Santa Cruz, I know my friend just this last weekend, I don't know how many days ago that was, he got stopped by the cops, and they tried to arrest him just because he didn't have an ID with him. He didn't have an ID.
Are you talking about stop driving or
stopped walking? Walking at night, and they asked him where's his ID and who he was.
Do we know this person? Has he or she gone public?
No, I mean, they that's what I'm saying. Like, things like this, people don't go public about just because they happen so regularly. I mean, the reason we went public, which we weren't even intending to do, was because of the whole financial thing. But, I mean, these things happen regularly.
Veronica, you said a few moments ago that there was another incident you wanted to bring up and discuss. Did you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't mention names because I'm not sure if this person would like to be revealed, but there was an Indian man who was approached by a man from Denmark who was an exchange student here, and he asked him, are you Indian? And he said, yeah. He said, and he started going off about, well, oh, Indian people are the lowest life form on earth, blah, blah, blah. And so somehow the two men end up getting in a fight, and the man from Denmark stabbed the Indian man. And
Indian meaning American Indian or
East Indian.
East Indian, okay.
And he had to go to the hospital and this and that. And he tried to press charges on the guy who stabbed him, and the police said, no, you can't do that, because he's from Denmark. And the man from Denmark made up this story that the Indian man and three of his friends ganged up on him and beat him up. So now there are all these charges, you know, on him, and he had to go to jail, and he has an arraignment to go to. But yet he can't charge the man who stabbed him. And this happened on the same day that arson happened,
February
which was
14th.
Valentine's Day, on Pacific Avenue.
Very interesting. So if somebody wanted to find out who this man was, all you have to do is go check the booking records, folks, which, by the way, are open to the public. So if you're interested in this case and you want to investigate a little further, it's a public record. You can check it out at the sheriff's office. Look for bookings of a fight that happened on Pacific Avenue. This man, you knew the man who is now in jail, Veronica, or you just heard about it?
No, I know people who are friends of his.
And what are they planning to do? Are they planning to do some sort of defense work for this person?
Yeah, or? I mean, right now he's looking for a lawyer, but I mean, as students, young people, we don't have much money, so
he's a student himself, or?
Yes.
We have an incoming call here. Let's see who's on the line.
Good evening, Robert. How you doing?
I'm good. Let's see if we can pump you up a little. Say something.
Pump me up there, Robert. Am I all pumped?
I think you are pumped up and you are...
Can you hear me?
You can be heard. Go ahead.
Okay. I hope so. Don't blame it on the equipment again.
Certainly not.
I was listening to your guests and wanted to input on some of this type of thing that happens all the time to people, how the police kind of use the law in order to you know, this racial profiling thing, and like what they did, they didn't even let her shut her lights off or, you know, get her books out of her car when, of course, any other person, like higher, you know, rich person or whatever, they probably would have went and gotten the books for them, that kind of thing. But it happens a lot, quite a bit, and I've been hassled myself for just the whole ID question. And then, you know, you just have to know your rights, and as soon as they know your rights, as soon as they know that you know your rights, then they're more than likely to back off a little bit. So.
Well, we're talking to I've got to reveal your secret identity,
secret
caller, Skidmark Bob, or sometimes known as Copwatch Bob in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually went out with video camera and a notebook, trying to document how police were behaving in Santa Cruz.
Well, I can't afford a video camera, but I do have a tape deck.
Audio tape recorder. And you, in fact, have been working with Free Radio Santa Cruz since the beginning, back in 1995. And you yourself were subjected to charges of terrorist threats for singing a song about shoplifting in the bookshop Santa Cruz, I believe.
Right.
That was called a terrorist threat.
Right.
And you also, were you not, when you went after a letter that you'd thrown into a trash can near the post office, they threatened to arrest you for that?
Yeah.
So you're
among other things.
it's
observing the CNET operation team in the park when, as a journalist, observing them in their undercover operation and being arrested myself for just standing there with a tape recorder and taping a thing, not saying a word. And being arrested for that, as well as other little, when people used to sell weed down by the river levee, I was taking a walk down there one day, and I noticed a bunch of cops in the bushes with a video camera. They were trying to be, you know, somewhat hidden, but they weren't doing that well, because bushes were flying everywhere.
So you stepped in to help and advise them.
I said, I better go home, so I started going away, and a cop cut me off, and he asked me what I was doing, and I said, well, I was taking a walk by the river. Is that all right? He said, see some ID. And I said, well, I don't have to show you any ID, you know, unless I've committed a crime. Have I committed a crime? Well, no. And I said, okay, then I don't have to show you ID. So where'd you learn that? You know, the first thing they tell you, well, you fucking lawyer, you know, something like that. And it's like, no, I don't have to show you my ID. And so then we started a little commotion. So then a lot of the customers weren't coming down because all these cops were standing out there in the pathway. So they ended up just letting me go. I just turned my back and walked.
Well, I think it's commendable you do these sort of civil rights seminars sort of on site. I mean, this is a way of getting the public and the police involved and letting them, you know, kind of understand the basic constitutional rights that each of us are entitled to have. Right, Bob?
Right. Well, there was an incident that happened this morning. There was a shooting that happened. I don't know if you know much about it.
Tell us about it.
There hasn't been too much on the news since there's a basketball game on Channel 46. This morning about 10 o'clock, I heard sirens flying down the street, and someone alerted me that's a listener of Free Radio alerted me that some guy was holed up in his house and some shooting had happened. And so I went out to the west side to try to find where this was. I was kind of in the black until I finally found out what was going on. And evidently there was a 7-year-old man that had... I'm really unclear as exactly what happened, but there was some medical people at his house, and he was refusing medical care, or he got in some altercation, but he was just not, he was refusing the medical people to do their work, and so they called the cops, and so the cops show up, about 3 officers or 4 officers, including Sergeant Swanick, and next thing you know, something happened. I don't know as how they approached this gentleman, who obviously was not all there, but he pulled out a gun and shot Sergeant Swanick in the side, and evidently it hit his flak vest or whatever. He didn't get, you know, seriously hurt. He just got a little bruised.
What did the police do?
Evidently, according to Jeff Locke, who's, what, the deputy chief?
Mm-hmm.
He interviewed him. There's a tape, and I don't know if you see it. It's up there. Has a little bit of interview. I didn't really get the... Nobody talked. I saw Catherine Byers out there. Some people told me that she knew what was going on, but she wouldn't talk to me. Mm-hmm. And various other people, and it was about the 400 block of West Cliff, which is right near Santa Cruz Avenue and all that. And evidently, they called the SWAT team in, who comes busting in with their... It's funny, they didn't have a SWAT van or nothing. They come busting in with their little cars, and they're all geared up. And I guess they threw some flashbang grenades in there and then raided the house and got him out, supposedly with no injury, but he wasn't moving when they pulled him out and put him in a stretcher and put him in an ambulance. And I don't know who the guy is, what his name is. I've tried to call Dominican, and they just, you know... tell me to talk to Lieutenant Habey, who, you know, is never at his office.
Lieutenant Habey, maybe Habey, as we call
him. Yeah. So evidently this guy, for some reason, shot at the police. I don't know if it was in defense or what, but he, you know, tried to take one cop with him. And he was refusing some kind of medical care. There was some altercation that happened, whether it was, you know, Swanick can be kind of an asshole to people. A lot of the people that I know that he's had altercations with, he's always been you know, this big asshole cop, which I'm sure we're all familiar with these days.
He's a big guy, I will say that for him.
But you know,
let me ask you, I mean, Robert, weren't you the guy, Bob, who called in and told us that predicted Robert Steffen was on the way out, the bag man down on Pacific Avenue, that he was about to be should we say seized and removed?
Oh yeah, he was seized a couple of times.
And he was, I think he has been removed, and he's not returned.
He
followed that story, yeah.
Huh, I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, if you had any follow-ups. I know we tried to reach him in, he was in Dominican last, I knew, about 4 or 5 days ago. And,
right.
It looks like our guests have got to get out of here, because they've got a 7 o'clock appointment. I want to thank you for calling in, and hey, let's throw some more of those seminars down on the levee.
Okay.
Hey, there is this California Homeless Civil Rights Organizing Project. You're welcome to come 9 to 2 on Monday. Quit your job and...
Quit my job.
And,
it's my day off.
Grow your hair long and quit your job, man.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Well, so we are reaching, I guess, the end of the time you could be here, Kiko. And I'm not sure, you're Veronica, I guess you guys are coming as a team in this. So you're going to take off together. Anything you want to sum up with, or any help you think you'd like to get from folks out there in Radioland?
I don't know. You know, like you just heard, this shit happens every day. It's nothing new. The best help is just to take down all these pigs, period. And so this don't happen to nobody. Right now, we're just trying to get the financial part worked out and that money back so we can get everybody paid back. And, you know, people have school, people are going places, got rent and all that kind of stuff. So that's probably the biggest part just with this particular thing. But on a larger scale, this really real small level is, you know what I mean, you just got to take all these motherfuckers down, period.
And like take them down. You want to be more specific? What do you mean by that?
I mean, you go beyond the police state. You take America back down and give it back to it's our territory.
You're suggesting should we say, remove those in positions of illegitimate power from those positions and return them to civilian life? Or are you saying that something even more severe than that?
Yeah, something more severe. But that's something to get into later.
Indeed.
But, and that, you know, Native Youth Movement got support for Jim Costner, giving props for what he did. Good one, Jim. We'll try and make it and see you before we head up north again. But that's about it. And I don't know, Veronica.
Any final words or thoughts, Veronica, from you? Awesome. Thank you both for being with us. And if folks want to leave a message for either Veronica or Kiko, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and we'll pass it on to you in case, you know, people got some reactions that they can't immediately give you since you are taken off. And thank you for being on Free Radio Santa Cruz, both of you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. Red Power, Free the Land, all that.
And this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, your free speech station. I myself don't recommend taking out police officers either on dates or in terms of any kind of a military action. I'm not inclined in either direction at the present time. However, I do want to hear what people's experience has been with the police. I believe the best way to deal with police misconduct in Santa Cruz is to publicize it, to witness it, to document it, and then to act politically to change it. And I commend people who do that, and I commend people like this couple who came forward to city council, and then I saw them there, and of course encouraged them to come on the air, and that's what this was all about. We're going to take a brief musical break, and we're going to continue with Bathroom Spears Broadsides here at 96.3 FM. Stay with us.
Okay, it's about 1:35, and we are on the line with Kick-Ass Kathleen of the Coalition on Homelessness of San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello, Robert.
And Kathleen, you are getting paid good money to work on the Coalition to set up a California Homeless Civil Rights Organizing Project meeting in Santa Cruz on March 19th. Is that right?
That is correct. March 19th, which is a Monday, and it'll be scheduled to be from 10 to 1. Although I'm hoping to sort of flush it out on either end by an hour so we can have some unstructured time to just network and catch up with each other. But we'll be coming from all over Northern California.
Right. Now, this is where is this going to be held, you know?
Yes, it's going to be held just at a wonderful individual has volunteered the rec room clubhouse space at her complex where she lives. And it's going to be in Santa Cruz then. Well, I could give directions, but you need that over the radio.
Do you have the address?
Yes, it's actually 201 Noble.
201 Noble.
201 Noble.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the corner of Palo Verde Terrace and Noble.
Great. And this is going to be, I guess, hopefully to start at 9 o'clock on March 19th, which is what?
Is a Monday.
It is a Monday, and going until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, perhaps.
Yeah, the meeting has been scheduled for 10 to 1, and so I'm the one who's just agitating to sort of extend it either before and or after
now,
by an hour.
What are you guys going to be talking about? Is this one of those, let's get some grants together for the Coalition on Homelessness again stories, or what exactly are we talking about?
No, actually, the Coalition on Homelessness is merely a participating member, and actually the Northern Regional site is located in their office in San Francisco. But this will be... this is the work group, which is all the various members have representation from all across the state, although this particular meeting is only Northern California. They're having their Southern California meeting during the same week. And we'll be discussing tools, basically. We're laying foundation for the organization. We're discussing what strengths we have in common and the documentation processes that we can use in common for documenting the civil rights abuses that are perpetrated on homeless folks.
Civil rights abuses? Isn't that kind of commie talk? What are you talking about here?
I'm talking about, people who have their sleeping bags and their food and their... Well, I just talked to a guy today who had his mother's ashes in an urn with him, and DPW, the Department of Public Works, came along and took all of his belongings from him and threw them away.
Well, I knew in San Francisco the Coalition on Homelessness has been, to some extent, pushing small claims lawsuits to recover, I guess, some kind of financial remuneration for these seizures. And you've been has that been successful up in San Francisco?
You know, you could swear by me. Back in 1997, myself and 10 other people took the city and county of San Francisco to small claims court for the illegal confiscation and then destruction of our property, and all 11 people either were offered a settlement and took it, or, as in my own case, took them to court and won.
How much did you eventually get?
Oh, I got the cost of my property that had been lost, I thought go straight in the compactor truck, and $50 beyond that for emotional distress.
What about the attorney? Were there attorney's fees, or?
No, it's small claims court. So
how many hours of your time did it take?
You have to represent yourself, but the coalition sort of walked everyone through the process.
How many hours did it take you of your actual time to... to get that
settlement?
Well, the
coalition facilitated that so much, it probably only took, total of my time, a couple of days' worth.
And how long was it?
Period of probably 4 months.
And so, in other words, it took you 4 months after the theft and destruction of your personal property by the police for being a homeless person to get that amount of money back.
Although it didn't need to take quite so long. Part of it was because we did it as a group, and so when you have 11 homeless people all living with no address, no phone, etc., it's hard to arrange meetings.
Uh-huh.
So it's hard to arrange meetings.
And has this practice, has this, shall we say, solution been used by other homeless people, and has it had an effect on the police in terms of their seizures, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's had much of an effect on the police, but then again, not much does.
Or the Department of Public Works, let's say.
It has been used by quite a few people. It's an ongoing process. We had 10 or 14 folks who, when Mission Rock, the big shelter up here that closed, when it closed and just rampantly destroyed or threw away or took people's property, 10 or 14 of those folks took them to small claims court for that and won. And we actually also just have had this, in this last month, the first time ever, that before you can take the city or the county to court, you have to file an administrative claim against them first. They have to have the opportunity to, basically say, no, sue us. Well, for the very first time...
That's our city council's favorite word to such claims. No, no, no.
Yeah. Well, sometimes they don't even bother to reply. You just have to wait 45 days, and then you assume it's a no, and so then you sue them. But we actually had, in this last month, for the first time ever, someone's administrative claim against the Department of Public Works for taking their stuff was found to be valid, and they sent her a check.
Wow.
They basically flat-out copped it. Yep, you're right. We took your stuff illegally.
But you haven't noticed a lessening of these kinds of illegal practices by the police yet?
No. Lessening, no. We don't see a lessening in any of the abuses that are going on. That's why we're fighting currently to have some legislation passed that would just the simplest of common courtesies, let alone legalities, require 24-hour notice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a piece of junk car that doesn't even have an engine in it, no tires, it's rusty, and it's sitting, it gets 72 hours notice, and you're talking about someone's survival tools, their food, their extra bedding, their extra clothes, their shelter against the storm.
Speaking of vehicles, we've seen up in Eugene and in Santa Barbara as a proposal a plan to set up sort of very small vehicular parking areas, about 3 vehicles each. I guess this is in Eugene and up in, and I guess in Santa Barbara they're talking about a large parking lot at night that would legalize vehicular sleeping for homeless people, using the new, supposedly novel argument, it's always been true, but now it's becoming so obvious because of the rents, that in Santa Barbara, an affordable home is a vehicle for most people, and will be for the continuing future, particularly for disabled people or for folks who are on aid, that there is going to be no other kind of lodging available. You have yourself a vehicularly housed residential association, which was meeting for a couple of years, trying to get together with the mayor and the mayor's office, and I understand a couple of years ago they essentially led that group down a blind alley and then continue to harass them. What's happening with the Vehicularly Housed Residents Association?
Well, yeah, and actually, it's kind of a shame. You're almost on track there. That is, we had the group, and they had this. They worked very hard to put together the concept for the Vehicularly Housed Residential Community, the VHRC, and it actually, amazingly enough, given the atmosphere here, got pretty much some city support and was actually prioritized in the mayor's budget. And unfortunately, the money that it was, pointed towards, HUD kicked it out because it did not. Vehicles do not match the HUD definition of housing, and so they won't fund them.
Well, certainly couldn't the city itself.
No, and certainly that was a part.
They could have kicked in some money themselves.
The city could certainly do, as they please, and they certainly could have supported it and found a site. And
I mean, how much money were you looking for? Millions of dollars, or
it was not a lot, no, because we're just talking about folks who wanted to take a site and put their own, sweat equity into it as a community, doing all of the maintenance and improvements and policing and all of that. All you need is somewhere where basically people can handle their sanitation needs and their security needs.
Well, in Santa Cruz, we've had the problem with our newest mayor, or we actually, some of us call him Emperor, Tim Fitzmaurice, supposedly a Green Party politician who has abandoned the Green Party platform, which bans sleeping bans, or says that's something that all good and loyal Green Party members oppose. He himself has taken to supporting the city's sleeping ban and has taken no action whatsoever to put into effect even looking for safe sleeping zones, as was unanimously mandated by the city council last June, and actually in April there was a memo from the previous mayor to do that. There's been no action at all. Do you anticipate that this conference will simply be, a chat fest, or is there actually going to be some kind of protesting involved to support the Santa Cruz homeless who are currently facing $54 tickets for sleeping at night and no action whatsoever? In fact, Fitzmaurice refused to put the sleeping ban on the agenda in spite of requests from another council member who had 200 signatures on a petition, and he wanted to meet that group and discuss it in open city council meeting. Fitzmaurice essentially said, no, you can't do that, even though he's not a strong mayor like Willie Brown. He's simply one of these rotating mayors that we have in the small towns where the city manager is king, pretty much. What I'm wondering is, will the California Homeless Civil Rights Organizing Project be involved in any kind of protest, as far as you know? What are your plans on that?
I would say for the March 19th regional meeting, no, just because we have not, we haven't planned on that. But I would say it's certainly the arena in which we will discuss the ways in which the statewide organization can assist the local organizations. But it's interesting to note that really the structure is such that it works the opposite way. The way that we're set up is that the statewide organization is not going to interfere with the local groups. The local groups are the groups that are already doing the work, protest, the action, as it were. And what we're looking to see is how can we support the local work.
So if the local groups request your support on that day, are you prepared to go down and give the mayor a piece of your mind?
I'm saying that would be the arena for it to bring it up, absolutely.
I see.
And that's the sort of thing that we're going to be discussing is, if we're all using the same sort of documentation and we send this not only to your local politicians, but we send the documentation, the records, the videos, whatever it's going to be, to also your state senators and to your state governor, and et cetera. So we're going to be discussing, what are those possibilities?
Now, I hope that you're going to be bringing down some written information and descriptions of your success with a small claims court prospect, since I suspect it's a statewide process that can be used to reclaim,
I would be happy to do that, and
that'd
I would
great.
Also bring down a copy of the legislation that we have proposed on the 24-hour notice. So.
Excellent. That which, of course, replicates what Oregon currently has in effect, that they have to give 24-hour notice before taking homeless people's belongings.
Well, it's a nice of the thief to give you a little notice.
Oh, yes. You want to have kind of the thrill. It titillates you a little more.
Yeah, it's really just horrendous because as far as I know, the only legal ground that anyone has to stand on is the concept of clearing abandoned property. Mm-hmm. And certainly, when you have folks taking, belongings out of the hands of people, when they're standing there saying, that's mine, I need that, can I have it? Well, that's theft.
Well, in Santa Cruz, we call that the blanket ban, and it's a way of maintaining law and order. There's another approach being used by Santa Barbara activists who are apparently, according to writer Peter Marin and social justice activist in the Street Spirit newspaper, they've been using this approach where they're using the necessity defense, and they've successfully used that in a couple of the cases where it's actually gotten to court. Usually they've gotten the cases dismissed through having the assistance of a former public defender who has in every case been able to find technical problems with the law, or the cops haven't shown up. So is there a similar system in place in San Francisco where a homeless person with a sleeping ticket can go in and deal with it through that legal assistance from the Coalition on Homelessness?
Yeah, we certainly have not been, to my knowledge, using the necessity defense, but there is in place, and we would love to see actually someone else take it on because it's so big. But we have, because, you know, for so many years we've seen that so many of these tickets are given out illegally and incorrectly, and so they need representation on them, but as an infraction, you're not entitled to a public defender, which is what most of these tickets are for: sleeping, you know, camping, sitting, et cetera. And so we have, over the years, we've put together what we call the Citation Defense Program, where we have attorneys who donate their time. We have one attorney who basically acts as the clearinghouse, and we log them all in the computer, send them over to her office. She fills out all the forms that have to go to the clerk of the court, and then they're adjudicated in batches, and the attorneys, you know, it's the only way they can do it, because, I mean, in 2000 alone, in that one year, there were almost 24,000 of these citations issued. We get a hefty percentage of those, certainly, so the only way we can do it, we can't go to every single court date. So we set a court date for, say, 15 or 20 of them, and the attorneys go and represent and adjudicate on those in batches.
So actually, probably the vast majority of these tickets are something that the Coalition doesn't handle, and people end up getting skewered by them, right?
Well, you know...
I'm not blaming the Coalition.
No, it's true, but that's also because you've got... Mayor Brown, 2 years ago, put an extra $250,000 in just to prosecute homeless folks for these so-called quality
offenses. He's following in Mayor Giuliani's paw prints.
That would be Mayor Brown. It's a shame, and unfortunately, the first permutation of that, incarnation of that program was really horrendous, because it was done by the city attorneys, who don't typically prosecute. And it is now back in the district attorney's purview.
Wait a minute, isn't the district attorney that man of the people, Terrence Hallinan, much beloved, who was going to stop all these anti-homeless activities?
Well, I have to say that certainly when he was first in office, he's the one who purged the computers of like 38,000 of these tickets, because he saw that they were in fact being written illegally. So, I mean, I have no, you know, neither here nor there on that. Bottom line is, the ticket shouldn't be issued in the first place.
So is he...
No ticket that is going to amend the behavior to where someone doesn't have to sleep or doesn't have to pee, you know, hello, doesn't have to keep themselves safe from, you know, the rain and the cold. So I just think that I use the necessity defense, but I'm not an attorney.
So nobody has ever used the necessity defense in San Francisco, to your knowledge? Because it can be used in infraction cases, you know. I mean, that could be done,
I don't
too.
See why not, yeah. Right. I don't know that anyone ever has. I don't know that they've had to, because I think it's clear that, for the most part, our system, our judges, what have you, you know, they don't want to prosecute people for having to sleep, you know.
No, well, you should talk to some of our judges.
And we're going to interrupt this interview with Kathleen of the Coalition on Homelessness with the reminder that there is going to be a meeting of the California Homeless Civil Rights Organizing Project on Monday the 19th at 210 Nobel Drive, to which everyone is invited in the townhouse there from 9 to 2. It's going to be a long meeting, and we're going to be talking about organizing so that people in different cities in Northern California can have, their civil rights sort of supported and mutually buttressed as we proceed. Boy, I'm having a lot of trouble getting some action on this phone here. We have on the line with us a man who also spoke at City Council on Tuesday. I think you spoke right after or soon after the couple...
with the impounded vehicle?
Yeah, Kiko and Veronica, yeah. Mm-hmm. And well, why don't you sign in here? Tell us who you are.
My name is Cole Larson. I'm a local Santa Cruzan.
Mm-hmm. And recapitulate what happened at City Council.
Two young people talked to the council explaining that they had been stopped for a moving violation, some petty thing about a traffic taillight out, and as a result of that, their vehicle was impounded, and the owner's belongings, including her textbooks for her classes, were put off limits to her, even though the vehicle was right there, and apparently she wanted to retrieve something from the vehicle, and this...
Actually, you know, we just had that couple in the studio.
Yeah, okay, well...
Have you been listening on the air? Or?
I have not, no.
Yeah, well, they actually gave us a rather, very vivid description, and you were moved to come and speak. Remind us of what you were talking about.
Well, it was coincidental because I had planned to talk to the council or before the council on this particular thing, and I had a situation occur with my vehicle last month that in many ways parallels what had happened to them, except mine was a standing vehicle rather than a moving target, and it was the subject of a hit-and-run accident. And what happened was one bright sunny morning a month ago, I watched a motorcycle patrolman pull up to the back of my vehicle and get off and walk all around the vehicle, testing all the doors to see if any were open, to see if he could do more of a search, but they were locked. And he got on his motorbike and went away, and a few minutes later he came back a second time and drove his motorbike up on the sidewalk and looked at the passenger side of the vehicle. And a couple minutes later, he drove away. And
let me ask you this. Were you inside or outside the vehicle?
I was viewing this from approximately, 75 feet away across the street.
How long ago was this?
A month ago.
And what time of day?
It's about 10:30 on a sunny Tuesday morning.
Uh-huh. And where was all this?
Adjacent to the City Hall.
Really?
Yeah.
And he drove up on the sidewalk of City Hall?
Well, on the other side of the street. But, mm-hmm.
Okay, and what kind of a vehicle are we talking about, or should we? Should
I ask? I had a terribly ugly old van that probably was
one of the motivations, you think?
Maybe a motivation, yeah, certainly. Anyway, after the second inspection, he drove away and came back the third time a few minutes later, and stood behind the vehicle off to one side, and I noticed that he was taking an interest in the license plate. And I saw him, bend forward, and I was having a conversation with someone else at the time, so I wasn't watching him every particular second, but he drove away a third time, and it so happened a few minutes later, he and I met, and I came around the corner, and his motorbike was there, and he came out of the City Hall area in the courtyard, and he knew me by my first initials, which was, knew me by sight. And I had never, to my knowledge, laid eyes on him. But he asked me about the ownership of the van across the street, and I said it was mine. And he asked if I had driven it in the last 20 minutes, and I said no. And he asked if anyone else had driven it, and I said no. And he said, "Are you sure no one's driven it, including yourself?" I said, "No, I'm positive it's been sitting there all since yesterday." And he said, "Well, I've got a couple witnesses, two blocks from here. I've got three witnesses, two blocks from here that say a vehicle just like that, without a state license plates, was involved in a hit and run accident." And I said, "Well,
what's the name of this police officer?"
I'd be hesitant to say because I plan on going through with legal action at this point.
Uh-huh.
But I told him at that point that I'd be adamant about having the witnesses take a polygraph, and myself included.